touches Jocelyn's knee. Jocelyn flinches a little, pulls away. Even in that momentary touch, Allie knows what Jocelyn's trouble is. She knows the touch of women and the slow, even background hum of power in the skein. Something is dark in Jocelyn that should be lit and glowing. Something is open that should be closed. Allie suppresses a shudder. "Your skein," says Mother Eve. "You are suffering." Jocelyn cannot speak above a whisper.
"It's a secret. I'm not supposed to talk about it. There are drugs, but the drugs don't work as well anymore. It's getting worse. I'm not like other girls. I didn't know who else to come to. I've seen you on the internet. Please,"
she says,
"please, heal me and make me normal. Please ask God to take the burden from me. Please let me be normal."
"All I can do," says Mother Eve, "is take your hand, and we will pray together." This is a very difficult situation. No one's examined this girl, or given Allie advice about what her problem is. Skein deficiencies are very difficult to correct. Tatiana Moskalev is looking into skein transplant operations for precisely this reason. We don't know how to fix a skein that doesn't work. Jocelyn nods and puts her hand in Allie's. Mother Eve says the usual words. "Our mother," she says, "above us and within us. You alone are the source of all goodness, all mercy, and all grace. May we learn to do your will as you express it to us daily through your works." While she speaks, Allie is feeling out the patches of darkness and light in Jocelyn's skein. It's as if the thing is occluded. Gummy places where there should be flowing water. Silted up. She could clear some of the muck in the channels here and here. "And may our hearts be pure before you," she says, "and may you send us strength to bear the trials we face without bitterness and without self-destruction. Jocelyn, though she has rarely prayed, prays now. As Mother Eve lays her hands on Jocelyn's back, she prays,
"Please, God, open my heart."
And she feels something. Allie gives a little push, more than she'd usually do, but this girl doesn't have enough sensitivity to feel what exactly she's doing, probably. Jocelyn gasps. Allie gives another three short, hard pushes. And there. The thing is sparkling now, thrumming like an engine. There. Jocelyn says,
"Oh, God, I can feel it."
Her skein is humming steadily, evenly. She can feel now that thing that the other girls say they felt. The gentle filling sensation as each cell in her skein pumps ions across membranes and the electric potential increases. She can feel that she's working properly. For the first time ever. She is too shocked to cry. She says,
"I can feel it. It's working."
Mother Eve says, "Praise be to God."
"But how did you do that?"
Mother Eve shakes her head. "Not my will, but hers be done." They breathe in and out in unison. Once, twice, three times. Jocelyn says,
"What shall I do now?
She laughs.
"I'm shipping out tomorrow. United Nations Observation Force duty in the South."
She's not supposed to say that, but she can't help herself. She couldn't keep a secret now in this room.
"My mom sent me there because it looks good, that I won't really be in danger. No chance of getting into trouble,"
she says. The voice says,
"Maybe she should get into trouble."
Mother Eve says, "You need have no fear now." Jocelyn nods again.
"Yes,"
she says.
"Thank you. Thank you."
Mother Eve kisses her on the crown of the head and gives her the blessing in the name of the Great Mother, and she goes down to the party. Tatiana is followed into the room by two well-built men in fitted clothing. Black t-shirts so tight you can see the outline of their nipples, skinny trousers with noticeable crotch bulges. When she sits in a high-back chair on a dais, they sit beside her on somewhat lower stools. The trappings of power, the rewards of success. She rises to greet Mother Eve with a kiss on each cheek.
"Praise be to Our Lady," says Tatiana.
"Glory in the highest," says Mother Eve, without a trace of Ali's sardonic smile.
"They've found 12 more traitors, captured in a raid on the north,"
mutters Tatiana. "With God's help, they will all be found," says Mother Eve. There are infinite numbers of people to meet. Ambassadors and local dignitaries, business owners and leaders of new movements. This party, coming so soon after their defeat in the Battle of the Dniester, is meant to shore up support for Tatiana both at home and abroad. And the presence of Mother Eve is part of that. Tatiana gives a speech about the heart-rending cruelty done by the regimes of the North and the freedom she and her people are fighting for. They listen to the stories of women who join together in small bands to seek Our Lady's vengeance on those who have escaped human justice. Tatiana is almost moved to tears. She asks one of the smartly dressed young men standing behind her to bring drinks for these brave women. He nods, backs away, almost tripping over his feet, and heads upstairs. While they wait, Tatiana tells one of her long-winded jokes. It is about a woman who wishes she could combine her favorite three men into one man, and then a good witch comes to visit her. The young blonde man bounds in front of her with the bottle.
"Was it this one, madam?"
Tatiana looks at him. She tips her head to one side. The young man swallows.
"I'm sorry," he says. "Did I tell you to speak?"
she says. He drops his eyes to the floor.
"Just like a man," she says. "Does not know how to be silent. Think we always want to hear what he has to say. Always talking, 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 interrupting his betters."
The young man looks like he's about to say something, but thinks better of it.
"Needs to be taught some manners," says one of the women standing behind Ali,
one of those who run the group seeking justice for old crimes. Tatiana plucks the bottle of brandy from the young man's hands, holds it in front of his face. The liquid sloshing inside is dark amber, oily like caramel.
"This bottle is worth more than you," she says. "A glass of this is worth more than you."
She holds the bottle in one hand by the neck, swirls the liquid around once, twice, three times. She drops it onto the floor. The glass smashes. The liquid starts to soak into the wood, staining it darker. The smell is strong and sweet.
"Lick it up," she says.
The man looks down at the shattered bottle. There are glass fragments among the brandy. He looks round at the watching faces. He kneels down and begins to tongue the floor, delicately, working his way around the pieces of glass. One of the older women calls out,
"Get your face into it!"
Ali watches in silence. The voice says,
"What the fuck?"
Ali says in her heart, "She is actually crazy. Should I say something?" The voice says,
"Anything you say will diminish your power here."
Ali says, "So what then? What is any of my power worth if I can't use it here?" The voice says,
"Remember what Tatiana says. We don't have to ask what they'd do if they were in control. We've seen it already. It's worse than this.
Ali clears her throat. The young man's mouth has blood at the lip. Tatiana starts to laugh.
Oh, for God's sake, she says. Get a broom and mop it up. You're repulsive.
The young man scrabbles to his feet. The crystal glasses are filled with champagne again. The music can once more be heard.
Can you believe he did it?
Says Tatiana, after he's run off to fetch a broom. Roxy.
It's a boring fucking party is what it is. And it's not that she doesn't like Tatiana, she does. Tatiana's let them get on with business over the past year, since she took over from Bernie. And anyone who lets you get on with business is all right by Roxy. Still, you'd think she could throw a better party than this. Someone had told her that Tatiana Moskalev went around this castle with her own bloomin' pet leopard on a chain. That's the disappointment Roxy can't really get over. Plenty of nice glasses, fine, plenty of gold chairs, all right, no bloomin' leopard, anywhere. The president seems only to have the dimmest understanding of who Roxy is at all. She goes and does the line-up to shake hands. The woman with the heavy mascara and the green and gold eyes says hello, and you are one of the finest business people who is making this country the greatest on earth and the most free, without a shadow of recognition crossing her face. Roxy thinks she's drunk. She wants to go.
Don't you know? I'm the woman shifting 500 kilos across your borders every day. Every day. I'm the one who's got you in trouble with the UN. Although we all know they won't do a fucking thing. Just send some more observing forces or whatnot. Don't you know?
Roxy necks some more of the champagne. She has a look out of the windows at the darkening mountains. She doesn't even hear Mother Eve approaching her until the woman is at her elbow. Eve's spooky like that. Tiny and wiry, and so quiet she could walk across a room and stick a knife between your ribs before you even knew it. Mother Eve says,
"The defeat in the north has made Tatiana unpredictable."
Yeah,
it's made it bloody unpredictable for me, too. I can tell you. Suppliers are nervy as fuck. 5 of my drivers have quit. They're all saying the war's going to push south. Do you remember what we did at the convent? With the waterfall?
Roxy smiles and gives a little laugh. That's a good memory. Simpler, happier times.
That's teamwork, she says.
I think we could do it again, says Mother Eve. On a larger scale.
How do you mean?
My influence. Your undeniable strength. I've always felt that there were great things ahead of you, Roxanne.
Am I really pissed? Says Roxy. Or are you making even less sense than usual?
We can't talk here. Mother Eve lowers her voice to a whisper. But I think that Tatiana Moskalev will soon have outlived her usefulness to the Holy Mother.
Oh. Oh. You kidding?
Mother Eve shakes her head minutely.
She's unstable. I think in a few months' time the country will be ready for a new leadership. And the people here trust me. If I were to say that you are the right woman for the job.
Roxy almost hoots with laughter at that.
Me? You've met me, ain't you, Evie?
Stranger things have happened, says Mother Eve. You're already a leader of a great multitude. Come and see me tomorrow. We'll talk it through.
It's your funeral, says Roxy.
She doesn't stay long after that. Just long enough to be seen to be having a good time and press the flesh of a couple of Tatiana's other disreputable cronies. She's taken with what Mother Eve said. It's a nice thought. A very nice thought. She does like this country. She stays out of the way of the reporters circling the room. You can always tell a fucking reporter from the hungry look on their faces. Even though there's one she's seen on the internet who she fancies, like she could lick his flesh straight off his bones. There's always more blokes where he came from.
A ten a penny. Especially if she were president. She mutters it under her breath. President Monk. And then laughs at herself for it. Still, good work. In any case, she can't think about it too hard tonight. She's got business to do this evening. Non-party, non-diplomatic, non-pressing the flesh business. One of them UN soldiers or special representatives or whatever wants to meet up with her somewhere quiet so they can work out how to circumvent the blockade in the north and keep product moving. Darryl set it up. He's been doing operations here for months, keeping his head down like a good boy, making contacts, keeping the factory running smoothly even during the war. Sometimes a bloke is better at that than a woman. Less threatening. They're better at diplomacy. Still, to finish the deal, it has to be Roxy herself. The roads are winding and dark. The headlights are the only pools of light in the black world. No streetlights here, not even a little village with lit windows. Bloody hell, it's only just gone 11. You'd think it was 4 o'clock in the morning. It's more than 90 minutes out of the city, but Darryl sent her good instructions. She finds the turnoff easily enough, drives down an unlit track, parks the car in front of another one of these spiky castles. All the windows are dark. No sign of life. She looks at the message Darryl sent her. Green painted door will be open. She makes a spark from her own palm to light her way. And there's the green door, paint flaking off, at the side of the stable block. She can smell formaldehyde and antiseptic. Another corridor, and there's a metal door with a round handle. Light is seeping in around the frame. Right. This is it. She'll bloody tell them next time not to have a fucking meeting somewhere unlit in the middle of nowhere. She could have tripped over and broken her neck. She turns the handle. And there's something weird. Just enough to put a frown between her eyes. She can taste blood in the air. Blood and chemicals. And there's a feeling like... She tries to pin it down. It's a feeling like there's been a fight. Like there's always just been a fight. She opens the door. There's a room lined with plastic. And there are tables and medical equipment. And she's thinking that someone didn't tell Darryl the whole story. And she has just enough time to be afraid when someone grabs her arms and someone else pulls a sack over her head. She gets off a huge blast. She knows she's hurt someone badly, could feel them crumble, and she hears the scream. And she's ready for another go. She's wheeling round and trying to get the bag off her head, and she's spinning and letting off jolts wildly into the air. She shouts, "Don't you fucking touch me!" and pulls at the thing on her head. And blood and iron bloom at the back of her skull, because someone's hit her as hard as she's ever been hit. And her last thought is, a leopard as a pet, as she goes down into night. She knows, even in her half-sleep, that they're cutting her. She's strong. She's always been strong. She's always been a fighter, and she's wrestling with the sleep like a heavy, sodden blanket. She keeps dreaming that her fists are clenched, and that she's trying to open them, and she knows that if she could only make her hands move in the real world, she would wake up, and then she would bring down such blood upon them. She would make the pain fall from the sky. She would open up a hole in the heavens and tumble the fires onto the earth. Something bad is happening to her. Something worse than she can imagine. Wake up, you fucker! Wake the fuck up now! She surfaces. She's strapped down. She can see metal above her, can feel metal under her fingertips, and she thinks, stupid fuckers. She's gonna set the whole bed humming because no fucker's coming near her. But she can't. She goes for it, and her accustomed tool is not in its place. A voice, very far away, says, it's working. But it's not working. That's the whole point. It is definitely not working. She tries to send a little echo along her collarbone. Her power's there. It's weak, struggling, but it's there. She's never felt so grateful to her own body. Another voice. She recognizes it, but where? Where? Whose is that voice? Has she kept a leopard as a pet? What is going on? Stupid fucking leopard padding through her dreams. Fuck off, you're not real. She's trying to break through. Watch her. She's strong. Someone laughs. Someone says, with what we've given her. I haven't come all this way, says the voice she knows. I didn't sort this all out to have you fuck it up. She's stronger than any of the others you've ever taken it from. Watch her. Fine. Mind out of the way. Someone comes near her again. They're going to hurt her, and she can't let them do that. She talks to her own skein, saying, You and me, mate, we're on the same side. You need to give me just a little bit more, the last little bit. I know you've got it. Come on. This is our life we're talking about. A hand touches her right hand. Fuck! Someone shouts and falls and breathes heavily. She's done it. She can feel it now, coursing more evenly through her, not like she'd been drained, like there'd been a block somewhere, and now it's clearing like debris in a stream. Oh, she is going to make them pay for this. Up the dose, up the dose. We can't give her any more. We'll damage the skein. Look at her. Fucking do it now or I'll do it myself. She's building up a great charge now. She's going to bring this ceiling down on them. Just look at what she's doing. Whose is that voice? It's on the tip of her tongue. When she's out of these restraints, she'll turn around and see, and somewhere in her heart she already knows who and what she'll see. There's a long, elongated mechanical beep. Red zone, says someone. Automatic warning. We've given her too much. Keep it coming. As suddenly as the power had built up in her, it went. Like someone had flipped a switch. She wants to scream. She can't make that come either. She goes down for a moment into the black mud. And when she fights her way back up again, they're cutting into her so carefully. It feels like a compliment. She's numbed, and it doesn't hurt, but she can feel the knife going in, along her collarbone. And then they touch her skein. Even through the numbness and paralysis and dreamy half-sleep, the pain sounds like a fire alarm through her body. It's clean, white pain. Like they're slicing very carefully through her eyeballs, shaving off layer after layer of flesh. It's a minute of screaming before she realizes what they're doing. They have lifted up the string of striated muscle across her collarbone, and they are sawing at it, separating it strand by strand from her. Very far away, someone says, Should she be screaming? Someone else says, Just get on with it. She knows those voices. She doesn't want to know them. The things you don't want to know, Roxy, those are the things that'll get you in the end. There's a twang all through her body when they cut through the final strand on the right-hand side of her collarbone. It hurts. But the emptiness that comes after is worse. It's like she's died. But she's still too alive to notice. Her eyelids flutter as they lift the thing out of her. She knows she's seeing now, not just imagining. She sees it in front of her. The strand of meat that was the thing that made her work. It's jumping and squirming because it wants to get back inside her. She wants it there too. Her own self. There's a voice to her left. The leopard says, Just get on with it. Sure you don't want to be under. They said you'd get better results if I could tell you whether it's working. Yeah. Then get on with it. And even though her head is in a vice and her neck is full of grinding gears, she turns her head so that just one eye can see what she's looking for. A single glance is enough. The man,
lying prepped for the implantation operation next to her, is Darryl, and sitting beside him in a chair is her dad,
Bernie.
There's the fucking leopard,
says a tinny, chattering part of her brain.
Didn't I tell you there was a fucking leopard somewhere here? You tried to keep a leopard as a pet, didn't you? You fucking idiot. And you know what happens then. Teeth at the throat, blood everywhere. Got what you deserved messing with a leopard. They don't change their spots, Roxy. Or is that cheetahs? Either way.
Shut up, 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 shut up!
She says to her brain.
I've got to think!
They're ignoring her now. They're working on him. They've sewed her up. Just to be neat, maybe. Or surgeons can't make themselves not sew up a wound they've made. Maybe her dad told them to. There he is. Her own dad. She should have fucking known that even not killing him wouldn't be enough. Everything's got its vengeance. A wound for a wound, a bruise for a bruise, a humiliation for a humiliation. She's trying not to cry. But she knows she is. Leaking from the eyes. She wants to mash them into the ground. The feeling's coming back into her arms and legs and fingers and toes. There's a tingling. And an emptiness, and an ache. And she's got one chance now because there's no reason at all for Darryl not to kill her. He might think she's dead already with any luck. Fucking snake in the grass, fucking shit stain on the earth, fucking Darryl! Bernie says, how's it looking? One of the doctors says, it's good. Excellent tissue match. There's a whining sound from the drill as they start to bore little holes in Darryl's collarbone. It's loud. She drifts in and out of time a bit. The clock on the wall is moving faster than it should. She can feel her whole body again. Fucking hell. They left her clothes on. That's shoddy. And it's good. And she can work with it. On the next whine of the drill, she wriggles her right hand out of the soft fabric restraint. She looks around with one half-open eye. She moves, slowly. Left hand out of the restraints. Still no one notices what she's doing. They're so intent on the body of her brother. Left foot. Right foot. She reaches out to the tray next to her, grabs a couple of scalpels and some bandages. There's some kind of crisis on the table next to her. A machine starts beeping. There's an involuntary jolt from the skein they're stitching into him. Good girl, thinks Roxy. That's my girl. One of the surgeons falls to the floor. Another swears in Russian and starts giving chest compressions. With two eyes open, Roxy gauges the distance between the table where she's lying and the door. The surgeons are shouting and calling for drugs. No one's looking at Roxy. No one cares. She could die now and no one would give a shit. She might be dying now. She feels like she could be. But she's not going to die here. She tips herself off the table down hard on her knees into a crouch and still none of them notices. She does a backward crawl towards the door, keeping low, keeping her eye on them. At the door, she finds her shoes and pulls them on with a little sob of relief. She topples out the door, hamstrings taut, body singing with adrenaline. In the courtyard, the car is gone. But limping, she runs out into the forest. Tunde. There is a man with a mouthful of glass. There is a thin, sharp, translucent sliver spearing the back of his throat, shiny with saliva and mucus, and his friend is trying to extract it with trembling fingers. He shines a light with his phone torch to see where it is exactly, and reaches in, while the man retches and tries to hold still. He has to go in for it 3 times, until he grasps it, pulls it out between thumb and forefinger. It is 2 inches long. It is stained with blood and meat, a lump of the man's throat on the end of it. The friend puts it on to a clean white napkin. Around them, the other waiters and chefs and orderlies continue with their business. Tunde photographs the 8 shards lined up on the napkin. He'd taken photographs while the obscenity was happening at the party, his camera casual and low at his hip, seeming to dangle from his hand. The waiter is just 17. This is not the first time he's seen or heard about such a thing, but the first time that he's been subject to it. No, he can't go anywhere else. He has relatives in Ukraine who might take him in if he ran, but people get shot trying to cross the border. It's a nervous time. He wipes the blood from his mouth as he speaks. He says quietly,
"It's my fault. I must not speak when the president is speaking."
He's crying a little now, from the shock and the shame and the fear and the humiliation and the pain. Tunde recognizes those feelings. He's known them since the first day Enuma touched him. He has written in the scribbled notes for his book, "At first, we did not speak our hurt, because it was not manly. Now we do not speak it, because we are afraid and ashamed and alone without hope. Each of us, alone. It is hard to know when the first became the second." The waiter, whose name is Peter, writes some words on a scrap of paper. He gives it to Tunde and holds his hand clasped over Tunde's fist. He looks into his eyes until Tunde thinks that the man is about to kiss him. Tunde suspects he would allow it, because each of these people needs some comfort. The waiter says,
"Don't go."
Tunde says, "I can stay as long as you like. Until the party is over, if you like." Peter says,
"No, don't leave us. She is going to try to make the press leave the country. Please."
Tunde says, "What have you heard?" Peter will only say the same thing.
"Please, don't leave us. Please."
"I won't," says Tunde. "I won't." He stands outside the kitchen for a smoke. His fingers are trembling as he lights a cigarette. He thought, because he'd met Tatyana Moskalev in the past, and she'd been kind to him, that he understood what was happening here. He'd been looking forward to seeing her again. Now he's glad he didn't have a chance to reintroduce himself. He pulls the paper that Peter had given him out of his pocket and looks at it. It says, in shaky block letters, "They're going to try to kill us." He gets a few shots of people leaving the party through the side door. A couple of gunrunners. A bioweapons specialist. It's the Horsemen of the Apocalypse Ball. There's Roxanne Monk, getting into her car, queen of a London crime family. She sees him photographing her car, mouths, "Fuck off," at him. He files the story with CNN when he gets back in his hotel room at 3 a.m. The photographs of the man licking the brandy up from the floor. The glass splinters on the napkin. The tears on Peter's cheek. Just past 9 a.m, he wakes involuntarily, gritty-eyed, sweat prickling his back and temples. He checks his email to see what the night editor said about the piece. He's promised anything that comes out of this party to CNN first, but if they want too many cuts, he'll take it elsewhere. There's a simple 2-line email. "Sorry, Tunde. We're gonna pass on this. Great reporting. Pics excellent. Not a story we can sell in right now." "Fine." Tunde sends out another 3 emails, then has a shower and orders a pot of strong coffee. When the emails start to come back, he's looking through the international news sites. Nothing much on Besipara. No one scooped him. He reads the emails. 3 more rejections. All for similar, foot-shuffling, non-committal, we-don't-think-there's-a-story-here reasons.
He's never needed a market, though. He'll just post the whole thing to his YouTube. He logs on via the hotel Wi-Fi and... There, YouTube isn't. Just a tiny takedown notice saying that this site is not available in this region. He tries a VPN. No good. Tries his cell phone data. Same deal. He thinks of Peter saying, she's trying to make the press leave the country. If he emails the files, they'll intercept them. He burns a DVD, all the photos, all the footage, his own piece. He puts it in a padded courier envelope and pauses for a moment over the address. In the end, he writes Nina's name and details on the label. He puts a note inside saying, hold this till I come fetch it. He's left stuff with her before. Notes for his book, journals from his travels. Safer with her than traveling with him or in an empty apartment somewhere. He'll get the American ambassador to put it in the diplomatic bag. If Tatiana Moskalev is trying to do what it looks like she might be trying to do, he doesn't want her to know yet that he's going to document it. He'll only get one chance at this story. Journalists have been expelled from countries for less than this, and he doesn't kid himself that it'll make any difference that he flirted with her once. It's that afternoon that the hotel asks for his passport, just because of the new security rules at this difficult time. Most of the other non-bureau staff are on their way out of Besipara. There are a few war reporters in flak jackets on the northern front, but until the fighting starts in earnest, there's nothing much to say here, and the posturing and threats go on for more than 5 weeks. Tunde stays. Even while he's receiving offers for substantial sums to go to Chile to interview the anti-pope and hear her views on Mother Eve. Even while more male activism terror splinter groups say that they'll only deliver their manifesto if he comes to take them. He stays. And he interviews dozens of people in cities across the region. He learns some basic Romanian. When colleagues and friends ask what the hell he's doing, he says he's working on a book about this new nation-state. And they shrug and say, fair enough. He attends the religious services in the new churches and sees how the old churches are being repurposed or destroyed. He sits in a circle in an underground room by candlelight and listens to a priest intoning the service as it used to be, the son and not the mother at the heart. After the service, the priest presses his body against Tunde's in a long, close hug and whispers, do not forget us. Tunde is told more than once that the police here no longer investigate the murder of men, that if a man is found dead, it is presumed that a vengeance gang had given him his proper reward for his deeds in the time before. Even a young boy, a father tells him, in an overheated sitting room in a western village. Even a boy who is only 15 now, what could he have done in the time before? Tunde doesn't write online about any of these interviews. He knows how that would end. A knock on the door at 4 a.m. and being hustled onto the first plane out of the country. He writes as if he's a tourist, on vacation in the new nation. He posts photographs every day. There's already an angry undercurrent to the comments. Where are the new videos, Tunde? Where are your funny reports? Still, they'd notice if he vanished. That's important. In his 6th week in the country, Tatiana's newly appointed Minister for Justice gives a press conference. It's sparsely attended. The room is airless, the walls papered with beige and brown string. After the recent terrorist outrages across the world, and after our country was betrayed by men who work for our enemies, we are announcing today a new legal vessel, she says. Our people have suffered for too long now at the hands of a group which has tried to destroy us. We do not have to ask ourselves what they will do if they win. We have already seen it. We must protect ourselves against those who might betray us. Thus, we institute today this law, that each man in the country must have his passport and other official documents stamped with the name of his female guardian. Her written permission will be needed for any journey he undertakes. We know that men have their tricks, and we cannot allow them to band together. Any man who does not have a sister, mother, wife, or daughter, or other relative to register him must report to the police station, where he will be assigned a work detail and shackled to other men for the protection of the public. Any man who breaks these laws will be subject to capital punishment. This applies also to foreign journalists and other workers.
Looks pass between the men in the room. There are about a dozen foreign journalists who've been here since it was a grim staging post in the business of human trafficking. The women try to look horrified, but at the same time comradely, comforting.
Don't worry, they seem to say. This can't last long, but while it does, we'll help you out.
Several of the men fold their arms protectively over their chests.
No man may take money or other possessions out of the country.
The Minister for Justice turns the page. There is a long list of proclamations printed close together in small type. Men are no longer permitted to drive cars. Men are no longer permitted to own businesses. Foreign journalists and photographers must be employed by a woman. Men are no longer permitted to gather together, even in the home, in groups larger than three, without a woman present. Men are no longer permitted to vote, because their years of violence and degradation have shown that they are not fit to rule or govern. A woman who sees a man flouting one of these laws in public is not only permitted, but required to discipline him immediately. Any woman who fails in this duty will be considered an enemy of the state, an accessory to the crime, one who attempts to undermine the peace and harmony of the nation. There are several pages of minor adjustments to these rulings, explanations of what constitutes being accompanied by a woman, and leniences in case of extreme medical emergency, because, after all, they are not monsters. The press conference becomes more and more quiet as the list is read out. The Minister for Justice finishes reading her list and calmly sets the papers down in front of her. Her shoulders are very relaxed, her face impassive.
That is all, she says. No questions.
In the bar, Hooper from the Washington Post says,
I don't care. I'm leaving.
He said this several times already. He pours himself another whiskey and plops three ice cubes into it, swirls them round hard, and makes his case again.
Why the fuck should we stay somewhere that we actually can't do our jobs, when there are dozens of places we can? Something's about to break out in Iran. I'm pretty sure I'll go there.
And when something breaks out in Iran, drawls Semple of the BBC, what do you think will happen to the men? Hooper shakes his head.
Not in Iran, not like this. They're not going to change their beliefs overnight, cede everything to the women.
You do remember, continues Semple, that they turned overnight when the Shah fell and the Ayatollah came to power? You do remember that it happens that quickly. There's a moment of quiet.
Well, what do you suggest?
Says Hooper.
Give up everything, go back home and become a gardening editor? I can see you doing that. Flak jacket in the herbaceous borders.
Semple shrugs. I'm staying. I'm a British citizen under the protection of Her Majesty. I'll obey the laws, within reason, and report on that.
What are you expecting to report? What it's like sitting in a hotel room waiting for a woman to come and get you?
Semple sticks his bottom lip out. It won't get any worse than this. At the table next to them, Tunde is listening. He also has a large whiskey, though he's not drinking it. The men are getting drunk and shouting. The women are quiet, watching the men. There is something vulnerable and desperate in the men's display. He thinks the women are looking with compassion. One says, loud enough for Tunde to be able to hear,
We'll take you anywhere you want to go. Listen, we don't believe in this nonsense. You can tell us where you want to go. It'll be just the same as it's always been.
Hooper clasps Semple by the sleeve, saying,
You have to leave.
First plane out of here and screw it all.
One of the women says,
He is right. What's the point of getting killed over this pisspot of a place?
Tunde walks slowly to the front desk. He waits for an elderly Norwegian couple to pay their bill. There's a taxi outside loading up their bags. Like most people from wealthy nations, they're getting out of the city while they can. At last, after querying each item on the minibar receipt and the level of the local taxes, they leave. There is only one member of staff behind the desk. Gray is colonizing his hair in clumps, a chunk here and there, the rest dark and thick and tightly curled. He's perhaps in his 60s, surely a trusted staff member with years of experience. Tunde smiles, an easy, we're-in-this-together smile.
Strange days, he says.
The man nods. Yes, sir.
You've planned what you're going to do?
The man shrugs.
You have family who will take you in? My daughter has a farm 3 hours west of here. I will go to her. They're going to let you travel?
The man looks up. The whites of his eyes are jaundiced and streaked with red, the thin bloody lines reaching towards the pupil. He looks for a long time at Tunde, perhaps 5 or 6 seconds.
If God wills it.
Tunde puts one hand into his pocket, easy and slow.
I have been thinking of travel myself, he says,
and pauses, and waits. The man does not ask him more.
Promising. Of course, there are one or two things I'd need for travel that I don't have anymore. Things that I wouldn't want to live without whenever I were to set off.
The man still says nothing, but nods his head slowly. Tunde brings his hands together casually, then slides the notes under the blotter on the desk so that just the corners of them are showing. Fanned out. $10, $50 bills. U.S. currency. That's the key thing. The man's slow, regular breathing halts. Just for a second. Tunde continues jovial. Freedom, he says, is all anyone wants. He pauses. I think I will go up to bed. Could you tell them to send me up a scotch? Room 614. As soon as you can. The man says,
I will bring it myself, sir, in just a few moments.
In the room, Tunde flicks on the TV. Kristen is saying,
The fourth quarter forecast isn't looking good.
Matt is laughing attractively and saying,
Now, I don't understand that kind of thing at all, but I tell you what I do know about. Apple bombing.
There's a brief roundup on C-SPAN about a military crackdown in this tumultuous region, but much more about other domestic terrorism action in Idaho. Urban Docs and his idiots have successfully changed the story. If you're talking about men's rights now, you're talking about them and their conspiracy theories and the violence of them and the need for curbs and limits. No one wants to hear about what's happening here. The truth has always been a more complex commodity than the market can easily package and sell.
And now the weather on the ones.
Tunde stocks his backpack. 2 changes of clothes, his notes, his laptop and a phone, water bottle, his old-fashioned camera with 40 rolls of film, because he knows there could be days when he won't find electricity or batteries, and a non-digital camera will be useful. He pauses, then crams in a couple more pairs of socks. He feels a kind of excitement welling up, unexpectedly, as well as the terror and the outrage and the madness. He tells himself it is stupid to feel excited. This is serious. When the knock on the door comes, he jumps. For a moment, when he opens the door, he thinks the old man has misunderstood him. On the tray, there's a tumbler of whiskey, sitting on a rectangular coaster, and nothing else. It's only when he looks more closely that he sees that the coaster is, in fact, his passport.
Thank you, he says.
This is just what I wanted. The man nods. Tunde pays him for the whiskey and zips the passport into the side pocket of his trousers. He waits to leave until around 4:30 a.m. The corridors are quiet. The lights low. No alarm sounds as he opens the door and steps out into the cold. No one tries to stop him. It is as if the whole afternoon had been a dream. Tunde crosses the empty night streets, the dogs barking far away, breaks into a jog for a few moments, then settles back to a long-legged loping pace. Putting his hand into his pocket, he finds he still has the key to his hotel room. He considers throwing it away, or putting it into a postbox, but fingering the shiny brass fob, he thrusts it back into his pocket. As long as he has it, he can imagine that room 614 will always be there waiting for him, still just as he left it, the bed still unmade, the morning papers by the desk in ungainly peaks, his smart shoes side by side under the bedside table, his used pants and socks thrown in the corner by his open, half-empty suitcase.
Audio guide for the Museum of Post-Cataclysm Artifacts. This climate-controlled case protects a piece of rock art chiseled from its original location. It shows a male figure lying prone while a female figure extends her hand towards his genitals. The display text reads, "Rock art discovered in northern France, around 4,000 years old. Depicts the curbing procedure, also known as male genital mutilation, in which key nerve endings in the penis are burned out as the boy approaches puberty. After the procedure, which is still practiced in several European countries, it is impossible for a man to achieve an erection without skein stimulation by a woman. Many men who have been subjected to curbing will never be able to ejaculate without pain."
Can't be more than 7 months left.
Ali. Roxy Monk has disappeared. Ali saw her at the party. The staff say they saw her leaving. There's security camera footage of her car driving out of the city. And then nothing. She was heading north. That's all they know. It's been 8 weeks. There's been nothing. Ali's spoken to Daryl on video chat. He looks terrible. "Just about holding it together," he says. "They've scoured the countryside for her. If they came for her, they would come for me," he says. "We'll keep looking for her. Even if what we find is a body, we have to know what's happened." They have to know. Ali has had wild and terrible thoughts. Tatiana's convinced with a sudden upsurge of paranoia that Roxy has betrayed her to North Moldova and interprets every new turn in the hostilities as a sign that Roxy sold her out, even given the glitter to her enemies. Tatiana is becoming unpredictable. At times, she seems to trust Mother Eve more than anyone. She has even signed into law a measure making Mother Eve the de facto leader of the country if she, Tatiana, is incapacitated. But she's having violent fits of rage, striking and hurting her staff, accusing everyone around her of working against her. She's giving contradictory and bizarre instructions to her generals and officers. There has been fighting. Some of the revenge bands have set fire to villages harboring gender traitor women and men who've done wrong. Some of the villages have fought back. There is a war slowly spreading in the country, not declared on a single day, between well-defined enemies, but spreading like measles. First one spot, then two, then three. A war of all against all. Ali misses Roxy. She had not known before that Roxy had found a chink in her heart. It makes her afraid. She hadn't ever thought of having a friend. It is not an item she'd particularly felt the need for, or the lack of, until it was gone. She worries. She has dreams in which she sends out first a raven and then a white dove, looking for good news, but no news returns on the wind. She would send out scouting parties to comb the woods if she knew where to look within 100 miles. She prays to the Holy Mother. "Please, Bring her safely home.
Please?
The voice says,
I can't make any promises.
Allie says in her heart, Roxy had a lot of enemies. People like that, they have a lot of enemies. The voice says,
You think you don't have a lot of enemies, too?
Allie says, What help are you? The voice says,
I'm always here for you, but I did say this would be tricky.
Allie says, You also said that the only way is to own the place. The voice says,
Then you know what you have to do.
She says to herself, Stop it now, just stop it. She is just a person like all of the other people. Everything will disappear and you will survive. Cut off this part of yourself. Shut off this compartment in your heart. Fill it with scalding water and kill it. You do not need her. You will live. She is afraid. She is not safe. She knows what she has to do. The only way to be safe is to own the place. There's a night when Tatiana calls for her, very late, past 3 a.m. Tatiana's been having trouble sleeping. She wakes in the night with bad dreams of vengeance, spies in the palace, someone coming for her with a knife. At these times, she calls for Mother Eve, her spiritual advisor, and Mother Eve comes and sits on the end of her bed and speaks soothing words until she falls asleep again. The bedroom is decorated with a mixture of burgundy brocade and tiger skins. Tatiana sleeps alone, no matter who might have been in the bed earlier in the evening. She says,
They're going to take everything from me.
Allie takes her hand, feels her way along the jangled nerve endings to the griping and disquieted brain. She says,
God is with you, and you will prevail.
As she says it, she presses, in a careful and measured way, on this part of Tatiana's mind and that one. Nothing you could feel. Only a few neurons fire differently. It's just a tiny suppression, a minute elevation.
Yes, says Tatiana. I'm sure that's right.
Good girl, says the voice.
Good girl, says Allie. And Tatiana nods like an obedient child. Eventually, Allie figures, more people will learn how to do this. Perhaps even now in some far-off place, a young woman is learning how to soothe and control her father or brother. Eventually, other people will figure out that the ability to hurt is only the beginning. The gateway drug, Roxy would say.
Now listen, says Allie. I think you'd like to sign these papers now, wouldn't you?
Tatiana nods sleepily.
You've thought it over? And the church really should have the ability to try its own cases and enforce its own statutes in the border regions, shouldn't we?
Tatiana picks up the pen from her bedside table and signs her name jerkily. Her eyes are closing as she writes. She is falling back onto the pillow. The voice says,
How long are you planning to drag this out?
Allie says in her heart,
If I move too quickly, the Americans will get suspicious. I meant this for Roxy. It'll be harder to convince people when I do it for me.
The voice says,
She's getting harder to control every day. You know she is.
Allie says, It's because of what we're doing. Something's going wrong inside her head with the chemicals. But it won't go on forever. I'll take the country, and then I'll be safe.
Daryl. The shipments are fucked up because of the fucking UN. Daryl's looking at the truck that's come back to him. It's dumped its bags in the woods, and that's 3 million quid of glitter bleeding out into the forest floor when it rains, which would be bad enough by itself. Except, that's not the only thing. They got chased from the border. They came rough through the woods to get away from the soldiers. But they gave them a trajectory, didn't they? If you're running from the border and you're heading in this direction, narrows down the options of where you might be, doesn't it?
Fuck!
Says Daryl, and kicks the wheel of the truck. His scar pulls taut. His skein hums angrily. It hurts. He shouts, fuck! Again, louder than he'd meant to. They're in the warehouse. A few of the women glance over. A couple start wandering towards the van to see what's happened. One of the drivers, the deputy, shifts her weight from one foot to the other and says, when we had to drop a load before, Roxy always...
I don't give a fuck what Roxy always,
says Daryl, a little too quickly. A look passes between the women. He pulls it back.
I mean, I don't think she wants us to do what we've done before. All right.
Another look between them. Daryl tries to talk more slowly, in a calm, authoritative voice. He finds himself getting nervous around all these women now that Roxy's not around to keep them in line. Once they know that he's got a skein himself, it'll be better. But this isn't the right time for any more surprises, and his dad says he's got to keep it secret until it's healed. Anyway, until he comes back to London. Listen, he says, we'll lie low for a week. No more shipments, no more border crossings, just let it all go quiet. They nod. Daryl thinks, how do I know you haven't been fucking skimming? There's no way to know. Say you've dropped a load in the forest, who's to know that you didn't keep it for yourself? Fuck! They're not afraid enough of him. That's the problem. One of the girls, a slow, thick one called Irina, makes a frown and pushes her lips forward. She says, do you have a guardian? Oh, this old fucking noise again. Yes, Irina, he says. My sister Roxanne is my guardian. You remember her? Runs this place? Owns the factory?
But Roxanne is gone.
Just on holiday, says Daryl. She'll be back, and for the time being, I'm just keeping everything ticking over for her. Irina's frown deepens, her forehead huge and crenellated.
I listen to the news, she says. If guardian is dead or missing, new guardian must be appointed for men.
She's not dead, Irina. She's not even missing. She's just... not here right now. She's gone away to do some important things. All right. She'll be back eventually, and she told me to look after this all while she's away. Irina turns her head from side to side to absorb this new information. Daryl can hear the gears and bones in her neck clicking.
But how do you know what to do? She says, when Roxanne is away.
She sends me messages. All right, Irina. She sends me little emails and text messages, and she's the one who's telling me to do all the things I'm doing. I have never done a thing without my sister's say-so, and when you do what I tell you, you're doing what she tells you. All right. Irina blinks.
Yes, she says. I did not know. Messages is good.
Good, then. So, is there anything else? Irina stares at him.
Come on, girl, dredge it up. What's in the back of that massive head?
Your father, she says.
Yes, my father what?
Your father. He has left you a message. He wants to talk to you.
Bernie's voice hums down the line from London. The sound of his disappointment makes Daryl's bowels turn to water, as it always has.
You haven't found her.
Nothing, Dad. Daryl keeps his voice low. The walls of his office at the factory are thin.
She's probably crawled off into a hole to die, Dad. You heard the doc? When they get their skeins cut out, more than half of them die from the shock. And with the blood loss and she was in the middle of nowhere. It's been 2 months, Dad. She's dead.
You don't have to say it like you're happy about it. She was my bloody daughter. What did Bernie think was going to happen? Did he think Roxy was going to come back home and run the bookies after they did that to her? Better bloody hope she's dead.
Sorry, Dad.
It's better this way, that's all. This is the way round things ought to be. That's why we did it. Not to hurt her.
No, Dad.
How's it bedding in, son? How you feeling?
It wakes him up every hour through the night, squirming and twitching. The drugs they've given him, along with the glitter, are making him grow his own controlling nerves for the skein. But it feels like a fucking viper inside his chest.
It's good, Dad. Doc says I'm doing well. It's working.
When are you going to be ready to use it?
Nearly there, Dad. Another week or two.
Good.
This is just the start, boy chick.
I know, Dad.
Daryl smiles. I'll be deadly. Come along with you to a meeting. No one will expect me to be able to do nothing. Then pow! And if we can get it to work on you, this operation, think of who we couldn't sell it to. Chinese, Russians, anyone with a prison population, skein transplants. Everyone's going to be doing it. We'll make a killing, Dad.
That we will.
Jocelyn. Margot sent her to a psychotherapist because of the shock and trauma of the terrorist attack. She hasn't told the therapist that she didn't mean to kill that man. She hasn't said that he wasn't holding a gun. The therapist works out of an office paid for by North Star Industries, so it seems like it might not be safe. They talk in general terms. She told the therapist about Ryan. Jocelyn said,
I wanted him to like me because I'm strong and in control.
The therapist said,
maybe he liked you for different reasons?
Jocelyn said,
I don't want him to like me for different reasons. That just makes me think I'm disgusting. Why would he have to like me for different reasons than any other girl? Are you calling me weak?
She didn't tell the therapist she's back in touch with Ryan now. He emailed her from a new address, a burner, after that thing happened at the North Star camp. She said she didn't want to hear from him. Couldn't talk to a terrorist. He said,
what? I mean, what?
It's taken him months to persuade her that it wasn't him on those bulletin boards. Jocelyn still doesn't know who she believes for sure, but she knows that her mother's got into the habit of lying so completely that she doesn't even know she's doing it. Joss felt something curdle inside her when she realized her mom might have deliberately lied to her. Ryan says,
she hated that I love you just how you are.
Joss says,
I want you to love me in spite of my problem, not because of it.
Ryan says,
I just love you, though. All the pieces of you.
Joss says,
you like me because I'm weak. I hate that you think I'm weak.
Ryan says,
you're not weak. You're not. Not to anyone who knows you, not to anyone who cares. And what would it matter if you were? People are allowed to be weak.
But that's the question, really. There are advertisements on hoardings now, with sassy young women showing off their long, curved arcs in front of cute, delighted boys. They're supposed to make you want to buy soda or sneakers or gum. They work. They sell product. They sell girls one other thing. Quietly, on the side.
Be strong, they say. That's how you get everything you want.
The problem is, that feeling is everywhere now. If you want to find something different to it, you have to listen to some difficult people. Not everything they say seems right. Some of them sound mad. That man Tom Hobson, who used to be on The Morning Show, has his own website now. He's joined up with Urban Docs and Babe Truth and some of the others. Joss reads it on her cell phone when no one else is around. There are accounts on Tom Hobson's website of things happening in Besapara that Joss can't really believe. Torture and experiments. Gangs of women on the loose in the north near the border, murdering and raping men at will. Here in the south, it's quiet, even with the growing border unrest. Jocelyn's met people in this country. They're mostly really nice. She's met men who agree that the laws are sensible for right now, while they're at war, and women who've invited her in for tea in their houses. but there are things she finds easy to believe too. Tom writes about how in Besapara, where she is right now, there are people doing experiments on boys like Ryan, cutting them to pieces to find out what's happened to them, feeding them big glops of that street drug called glitter. They say the drug's being shipped out of Besapara, pretty near to where she is. Tom's got Google Maps of the location on the site. Tom says the real reason the US Army is stationed where she is, in the south of Besapara, is because they're protecting the supplies of glitter, keeping everything orderly, so Margot Cleary can arrange her shipments of glitter from organized crime syndicates to North Star, who sell it back to the US Army at a marked-up price. For more than a year, the Army had been giving her a small regulation packet of a purple-white powder every 3 days for her condition. One of the sites Ryan showed her said that the powder makes girls with skein abnormalities worse. It increases the highs and the lows. Your system becomes dependent on it. But now, she's okay. She'd say it was like a miracle, but it's not like anything. It was an actual miracle. She was there for it. She prays every night in the dark in her bunk, closing her eyes and whispering, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." She's been healed. She's okay. She thinks to herself, if I was saved, there must be a reason. Joss goes to look at the unused packets stashed under her mattress and at the photos on Tom Hobson's site of the drugs he's talking about. She texts Ryan. Secret phone. Burner. He changes it every 3 weeks. Ryan says, "Do you really believe your mom's made a deal with a drugs cartel?" Joss says,
"I don't believe that if she had the opportunity, she wouldn't."
It's Jocelyn's day off. She signs a jeep out from the base. She's just going for a country drive, meeting up with some friends. That okay? She's the daughter of a senator tipped to run for the big house at the next election and a major stakeholder in North Star. Of course it's okay. She consults the printouts of the maps from Tom Hobson's website. If he's right, one of the drug manufacturing centres in Besapara is only about 40 miles away. And there was that weird thing that happened a few weeks earlier. Some of the girls from the base chased an unmarked van through the forest. The driver shot at them. They lost it in the end and reported it as possible North Moldovan terrorist activity. But Joss knows what direction it was heading in. There's a lightness in her as she gets into the jeep. She's got a half-day furlough. The sun is shining. She'll drive down to where the place should be and see if she can see anything. She's feeling light-hearted. Her skein is humming strong and true as it always does now, and she feels good. Normal. It's an adventure. Worst comes to worst, she'll have had a nice drive. But she might be able to take some photos to put online herself. But it might come out much better than that. She might find something that would incriminate her mother. Something she could email Margot and say, "If you don't back the fuck off and let me go and live my life, these are going straight to the Washington Post." Getting photographs like that, that wouldn't be a bad day at all. Tunde. It wasn't hard at first. He'd made friends enough to shelter him as he travelled first out through the city and satellite towns, and then towards the mountains. He knows Besapara and North Moldova. He'd travelled here, researching the story about Awadi Atif a lifetime ago. He feels curiously safe here. And a regime cannot, in general, turn overnight from one thing to another. Bureaucracies are slow. People take their time. The old man must be kept on to show the new women how the paper mill is soused down, or how the stock-taking check on the flour order is made. All over the country, there are men still running their factories, while the women mutter among themselves about the new laws and wonder when something will happen to enforce them. In his first weeks on the road, Tunde took photographs of the new ordinances, of the fights in the street, of the dead-eyed men imprisoned in their homes. His plan was to travel for a few weeks and simply record what he saw. It would be the last chapter of the book that's waiting for him, backed up on USB sticks and in filled notebooks, in Nina's apartment in New York. He'd heard rumors that the most extreme events had been in the mountains. No one would say what they'd heard. Not precisely. They talked grimly of backward country folk, and of the darkness that had never quite receded there, not under any of a dozen different regimes and dictators. Peter, the waiter from Tatiana Moskalev's party, had said,
"They used to blind the girls. When the power first came, the men there, the warlords, blinded all the girls. That is what I heard. They put their eyes out with hot irons, so they would still be the bosses. You see?"
"And now?" Peter shook his head.
"Now? We don't go there."
So Tunde had decided, for want of another goal, to walk towards the mountains. In the 8th week, it began to be bad. He arrived in a town by the edge of a great green-blue lake. He walked, hungry, through the streets on a Sunday morning, until he came to a bakery with open doors, a fug of steam and yeast leaking deliciously into the street. He proffered some coins to the man behind the counter and pointed at some puffy white rolls cooling on a wire rack. The man made the accustomed hands-open-like-a-book gesture to ask to see Tunde's papers. This had been happening more frequently. Tunde showed his passport and his news-gathering credentials. The man leafed through the passport, looking, Tunde knew, for the official stamp declaring his guardian, who would then have co-signed a pass for him to be out shopping today. He went through each page carefully. Having conscientiously examined it, he made the papers sign again, a little panic rising in his face. Tunde smiled and shrugged and tipped his head to one side. "Come on," he said, though there was no indication the man spoke any English. "It's just some little rolls. These are all the papers I have, man." Until now, this had been enough. Usually someone would smile at this point at the absurd foreign journalist, or give a little lecture in broken English about how he must be properly certified next time, and Tunde would apologize and give his charming grin, and he would walk out of the store with his meal or supplies. This time, the man behind the counter shook his head miserably again. He pointed towards a sign on the wall in Russian. Tunde translated it with the help of his phrasebook. It was roughly, $5,000 fine for anyone found to have helped a man without papers. Tunde shrugged and smiled, and opened his palms to show them empty. He made a looking-around gesture, cocking his hand over his eyes and miming a scouting of the horizon.
"Who's here to see? I won't tell anyone."
The man shook his head, clutched the counter, looked down at the backs of his hands. There, where his cuffs met his wrists, he was marked with long, whorled scars. Scars upon scars, older and newer, fern-like and coiled. Where his neck pulled away from the shirt were the marks too. He shook his head and stood and waited, looking down. Tunde grabbed his passport back from the counter and left. As he walked away, there were women standing in open doorways watching him go. Women and men who were willing to sell him food or fuel for his little camping stove became fewer and farther between. He started to develop a sense for those who might be friendly. Older men, sitting outside a house playing cards, they'd have something for him, might even find him a bed for the night. Young men tended to be too frightened. There was no point talking to women at all. Even meeting their eyes felt too dangerous. When he walked past a group of women on the road, laughing and joking and making arcs against the sky, Tunde said to himself,
"I'm not here. I'm nothing. Don't notice me. You can't see me. There's nothing here to see."
They called to him first in Romanian, and then in English. He looked at the stones of the path. They shouted a few words after him, obscene and racist words, but let him go on. In his journal he wrote, "For the first time today on the road, I was afraid." He ran his fingers over the ink as it dried. The truth
was easier there than here. Halfway through the 10th week came a bright morning, the sun breaking through the clouds, dragonflies darting and hovering over the pasture meadow. Tunde made his little calculation again in his head. Enough energy bars in his pack to keep him going for a couple of weeks. Enough film in his backup camera, his phone and charger safe. He'd be in the mountains in a week. He'd record what he saw there for a week more, perhaps, and then he'd get the fuck out with this story. He was in this dream so securely that, at first, rounding the side of the hill, he did not see what the thing was tied to that post in the center of the road. It was a man, with long, dark hair hanging down over his face. He had been tied to the post by plastic cords at his wrists and ankles.